we were driving up here, and there's all of these road signs, like the programmable ones that are usually like, buckle your seatbelt. Except now they all say, don't look at the eclipse while driving. And I just love that we live in a world where they have to be like, not only don't look directly at the sun, but don't do it while you're going 80 on a highway.
Please. Welcome to Depth and Distance, the podcast where we break leadership down into learnable skills. And mostly because I need to be a better leader and I would like to learn those skills. Today specifically, we're going to be talking about mental health, military mental health, and from the perspective of what can we do inside of the current system to help ourselves, help our sailors, and also what do we think needs to change about the system? It is a great conversation with an active duty military mental health professional. She's an embedded mental health officer right now. And I really hope that it provides you some perspective and some new information and ideas on how to help. Welcome, ma'am. Would you like to introduce yourself?
So my name is Dr. Courtney Pullman-Turner. I'm a lieutenant commander. I am a clinical psychologist, but I also like to refer to myself as a recovered SWO because when I initially entered the service, I came in as a SWO. So I did my initial commitment. I came off of active duty, tried to stay in the reserves while I was going through grad school, which was very challenging because I was also going through a divorce at the same time. So I ended up just transferring to the IRR. I was like, cut our losses, not thinking I would ever come back on active duty. And then I met my husband during grad school. And then my husband is actually, he was active duty then. He was deployed. I'm at the end of grad school and I'm sending him an email like, hey, I think I changed my mind. Is it cool if I apply for the Navy internship? And he was like, yeah, absolutely. But if you get it, I want to get out. So he's enlisted. He was like, I don't know. Okay. You're going to make like twice as much as me. Like, I want to bounce.
Yeah.
So he ended up staying reserves. He made chief this last season, which was an adventure.
Congratulations.
Interesting to see from the other side.
Yes.
So I came back in as a clinical psychologist. When I was a SWO JO, I actually went on limited duty for mental health. And yeah, right. I'm really open about that with the folks I work with too, because I want people to understand that limited duty doesn't mean game over. Mental health, going to mental health doesn't mean game over. And one of my reasons for coming back in was I just generally did not have a good experience with Navy mental health for a variety of reasons. And I felt like maybe I can make a change. Maybe I can do that a little bit better. And here I am. So I came back in 2014. I came in through the internship at Naval Medical Center San Diego. And since then, yeah, I love San Diego. Since then, I have been stationed in Naval Hospital Pensacola. And then I was with 5th Marine Regiment at Camp Pendleton. And I am currently in Everett. I'm the embedded mental health provider for the surface ships, all those small boys who don't have their own provider. Now I have eight ships. It was 11, but a couple of them have home port shifted. So
yeah. Wow. I thought for a brief second you were going to say that you were with the submarines. And I was like, that's like communities 1, 2, and 3 that I think fear mental health is like aviators, Marines, and submariners. Wow. I think that's really interesting that you, one, came from being a SWO, because I can imagine that that is quite comforting to a lot of people who approach you thinking you don't get it. And then two, it's interesting that you had a negative experience. You don't have to go into details if you want, but like, how did you go from, I need help, the help I got wasn't maybe what I expected or feel like I deserved, to I'm going to come back in and do something different?
Yeah. So it was so long ago, because I've been in for 20 years now, and this was maybe year 18 or 19 years ago. Okay. So year maybe like 2 or 3 that I went on limited duty.
So JG timeframe.
Yes. Yeah. I remember putting JG on while I was on limited duty. So somewhere in that. Yeah. So I had my pin, I deployed, my ship had gone to the yards, and like, I just kind of, I don't know what the other shoe was that dropped, but I couldn't hold it together anymore. And I remember the things I remember not being the provider's fault were, it's very hard to get appointments, which now I understand that's a systemic problem, right? So it's hard to get on appointments. So I went to Fleet and Family for like ongoing counseling, and my counselor was great, but I just didn't feel like she was meeting my needs. Like, we weren't going deep enough. I kind of could already reason out at the level she was able to help me. And so, and I, then I had a couple encounters with, I kept getting switched providers, which is also one of the struggles of the system. So I think I only ever saw like the same therapist in the Navy, like maybe twice. Yeah. And they kept switching diagnoses on me. And I felt a little bit like, and I get this more now that I am in the field, you kind of have to check yourself as a provider to not put everybody in the same box or everybody into little boxes, like to really be engaged and treat each person like the individual that they are. And I think there was a little bit of putting me in a box that maybe captured some of what I was experiencing, but not all, and not all of who I was. So essentially I got some books and I taught myself CBT. Yeah. I took my medication and over time I got better. And then by the time, go ahead.
No, I hate that from the perspective of you had to like take matters into your own hands. I love it from the perspective of, I think something I experienced was I expected going to therapy to be like the magic bullet that would fix it.
Yeah.
And what it really ended up being was me doing a lot of the work, not necessarily because of my therapist, but because usually there's some work to be done.
Yeah. Oh, I remember one of the things that was really a terrible experience. So medication, my family had not really talked about mental illness. Of course, when I told them, hey, I'm on limited duty for this, I'm off the ship, all of a sudden I start learning all these things about like my grandparents and my great grandparents, right? But I didn't know anything about psychiatric medication. And I remember asking the psychiatrist, you know, what are the side effects? What is this going to do? He was prescribing me at the time, it was an SSRI. Right? So an antidepressant. And he wouldn't tell me the side effects because he was like, well, if I tell you, you're going to say you have, which is just, completely unethical, which I also understand now.
So I remember informed consent is apparently not a real thing. Okay.
So because he didn't tell me what would happen, my imagination just ran wild with it. I remember the bottle sitting on my coffee table and I was just like staring at it, having an existential crisis, like, you know, I was crying. I was like, is this going to change who I am? Like, am I going to recognize myself? And thankfully I just took it. Right. But holy hell, no, like that's not how you treat your patients.
Yeah. And I think that hits on, and we'll get more into this in a second, but for sure, some of the fear surrounding mental health, at least for me, was if you tweak this one thing, especially with medication, it feels like pulling on like a spider web and like, what are all the other things that are going to change? And I think people talk explicitly a lot about, oh, is it going to impact my career? And I think that's always like so scary because depending on the community, depending on the diagnosis, depending on the medication, depending on where you're at 6 months from now, like all of those things can like trickle down. And so it's hard to say firmly yes or no, which is, I think, as frustrating for the providers as it is for the patients. But yeah, it feels like it pulls on a lot of other things too. I initially got put on an SSRI and I what is it, 6 weeks between when you first get a medication and you have to do a check-in at Navy Medical. So I went back in 6 weeks later and I had put on like 25 or 30 pounds because they do the whole like blood pressure, weigh you, whatever. And I remember going in and being like, look, not 30 pounds worth of stuff has not changed in my life. This medication is doing something. And I happened to be at a civilian provider who was at the Naval Hospital at the time. And I had so much trouble articulating to her that this isn't vanity. If I put on 30 pounds, I could lose my job.
Yeah.
And it was like, and so it's like all of those things that medication can touch that it feels like it impacts our careers, which is scary.
Yeah. I do want to touch on really quick too. You mentioned like whether or not it's going to impact careers. So a few years ago, I was actually on a dissertation committee for someone from my graduate school program. And she did her dissertation on, she looked at gender differences and whether or not seeking mental health care resulted in permanent duty disposition changes. So how often was somebody getting like, So what was really interesting, and I think this was, and there wasn't a lot of research in this area yet because there just wasn't a lot specifically addressing this in her lit review. Mm-hmm. But one of the findings was that people who went to mental health sooner were less mm-hmm. likely to end up being medically separated. So from the time they started experiencing symptoms, they didn't wait as long. And I think that's something I always emphasize, that like when I go to the ships and do training, the sooner the better, right?
Yeah.
We're all, so you haven't been on a surface ship yet, correct?
It's coming. Yeah. Give it 6 months.
So you'll probably get an opportunity to become intimately familiar with 3M, which is.
Okay. We did have 3M on the sub. I do remember this. Oh, yes.
Okay, right. Okay. You're on a sub. Yes, absolutely. Then you are already familiar with 3M, right? So are you going to wait to do the maintenance on yourself until you're like really broken? Or are you going to be like, hey, this isn't, I'm not operating at baseline, you know, at some point before you're completely broken, maybe think about going in for some maintenance.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to kind of look at it that way. The paper also found that women were separated at a lower rate than men because they came to mental health sooner.
Yeah. And I think that's, there's probably a lot of, I don't know how much she went into what causes that. I think anecdotally, probably more acceptable for women to seek mental health care in the military because there isn't some sort of, but there's less stigma around having feelings, which I feel like is a little reductionist. But, you know, I think there's a lot more pressure on men to be stoic. At least that's been my experience. And so I didn't feel the same level of judgment, deserved or not. And I think that the judgment is often worse in our own heads than our actual shipmates feel.
Yeah.
But if everyone will forgive my use of shipmates, but I think
I use it too, not in a derogatory way.
So. It's so confusing. Some commands it's very derogatory and some it is not. And I just, I don't know. My brain is confused. It can't figure out which is true or not.
Who would you call someone shipmate?
That's a lot more.
If you refer to your shipmates, fine. But if you call someone, hey, shipmate, like that's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That falls under like Roger that.
Like, yes. Yeah.
I know what you're saying, man. I know what you're saying when you say Roger that. So from your perspective, having been both a provider and somebody who sought military mental health, which I'd like to believe it's changed in the last 18 years, but I think a lot of the problems, as you said, are system wide and so are slow to change. What do you think, like, what do you wish more of your patients, leaders, like on the ship, in their division, understood about military mental health?
Well, first of all, we did not have embedded mental health when I was a junior officer. And I think, I mean, I had the advantage of coming into it with having been assigned to a ship before as a SWO. But even without that, the opportunity to gain competency in the culture that you're serving is drastically increased when you have embedded providers, which is one of the main advantages. What I think, and I feel like I have a good understanding current with all the triads I work with currently, but something I like leaders to take away, and not just at the triad level, is that most of the things that come to see us didn't initially need us. Us being a licensed independent provider, right? So things that, and a lot of things that I end up working with, I'm able to go work with the commands and create solutions with changes that I couldn't do on my own, nor could the patient, right? So the environment plays a big role, and there's no amount of mental health care that can make up for an environment that exceeds someone's capabilities to cope. We can work on further developing their coping, but a lot of changes can be made in the environment that are reasonable and do not have a negative impact on the mission. There's one case example that stands out to me in particular. There was a young sailor who came to me and needed some additional help with coping strategies, but also through our conversations, I learned that she was on 3 watch bills underway. Yeah. So she was on a UI watch. She was on like 2 UI watches and a regular watch. And her regular watch was with the same position that she was UI for the other watch. And so they would put those watches back to back. And obviously, they're going to be giving her some training during her regular watch as well, right?
Yeah.
And so she would have like 6 or 8 hours of just someone trying to train her continuously. And then she was on this other watch bill. And so she wasn't getting enough sleep either. And it was just an oversight that she was on 3 watch bills. And then when I was working with her, I was like, do you feel like if you just had some space between the UI watch and the regular watch, would that be helpful? And she said, yes. And the command, when I worked with the command, they were able to do that.
Yeah.
And it's really cool because now that sailor is back out in the fleet and doing amazing things. Right. And then I think there was something else, like, I think she was putting pressure on herself maybe, and also some of the chain of command to kind of follow the same pace that this just really shithot sailor was. Is it okay to swear here?
Yeah.
Okay, good. This really should not
be. I have the explicit logo. People know
perfect.
That.
Perfect.
There are sailors on this podcast.
Yeah. So comparing herself to like the cream of the crop, and everyone can't always be an EP sailor, and emphasizing with the chain of command that may not be where she's at right now. And maybe if that other person wasn't there, she would be the EP sailor. Right. And so Stop comparing them. It's not a competition. Everyone can get qualified. There's not a certain amount of people who can be qualified on a watch.
Yeah. Well, and I think what's interesting that you said there is like, you know, she's not the EP sailor right now. And right. I think one of the things that it took me a long time to come to terms with is just because you are an EP sailor for a couple of years when things are going good in your personal life, or you're jiving at the command, or you have a really solid enlisted leader or a really solid XO, or, you know, whatever, like it's possible for you to be an EP sailor and then for circumstances to change mm-hmm. and for you to have a period where you are not the shit hot sailor. And that I think if leaders were to some extent, you know, more compassionate in saying like, okay, we have a hot runner here and we have someone who's struggling here. And instead of viewing that as shit hot and shit, it's this person is thriving in this environment. If I want to have 2 fully capable sailors, we have to look at what about the environment. And sometimes that's things in your control and sometimes it's not, right? Sometimes right. It really is like an attitude problem or a personal life problem that is outside the scope of leadership to solve or whatever. But sometimes it is as simple as like a little break here. And I think the messaging that gets lost in a lot of that is like, well, if you're slower than or you need a special accommodations, you're holding the team back. Well, what would hold the team back is if this person taps entirely.
Mm-hmm.
What won't hold the team back is this sailor mm-hmm. performing at 90% with a little bit of flexibility in their leadership while we sort some stuff out, right? And I think that's where a lot of the mismatch happens.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I will say when I was with the Marines, that was something that they did really well, is everyone didn't have to be the top performer. Everyone didn't have to be an outstanding Marine. They could just be an adequate Marine. Like, they're like, hey,
yeah.
He shows up, he's in the uniform of the day, he's respectful, he does his job, he's on time. Right? And that's, you know, okay. That's okay.
That's what I want from most of my sailors. I hope my future Suppo and XO do not tune into this. So Commander Maidenbauer and Admiral York, please do not tell them to tune in. I don't want all of my sailors to have 55 collateral duties and be qualified on everything they can possibly be qualified on and be standing 20 hours of watch a day. I don't. I think that's a recipe for burnout.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a recipe for them to get real bitter real fast about the Navy. I think it comes at the cost of their personal lives, whether that's relationships or health or mental health. Because I think one of the things that I've discovered is anyone, no matter, you know, where the floor of their coping skills is, with a certain amount of pressure and over a certain amount of time, anybody can develop a mental health problem. And if we expect every sailor to be the shit hot EP for 20 straight years of a career, they're all going to hit that point. They're all going to hit some point where the two unbalance. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And also, so while we're still kind of talking about what I would love for a chain of command to know, for leadership to know, I talk a lot about when I do my resiliency trainings. I kind of have the first one that I do when a command invites me because it's the most relevant and kind of easy to follow. And then I have others if they invite me back for more. But one of the things I start off talking about is fixed versus growth mindset. And a lot of us, get stuck in a fixed mindset. And just because you have a growth mindset in some areas doesn't mean that you don't sometimes encounter a fixed mindset. And if you think about it, now I'm not saying like laziness doesn't exist. I'm not saying that bad attitudes don't exist. Those things are very real and they can be problems in and of themselves. But sometimes that's coming from a place of someone feeling like they are inadequate. And so if you genuinely believe, so fixed mindset is kind of the idea that this is what I got, right? So
smart or stupid, I'm talented or untalented.
Yes. Yeah. The example that I usually give when I'm teaching is math, because I really struggled with math as a kid. And I was lucky enough to have parents who didn't allow me to not do better at math. Like they made sure I had the resources and they made sure I had consequences for not putting in the work. And through that, I learned a growth mindset. But initially, I just thought, I'm bad at math, period. I am bad at math. So if you're genuinely believing that you are terrible at something and you do not have the capacity to get better, you're not going to respond positively when people try to mentor you or teach you, right?
Yeah.
And so sometimes the first thing we have to do is help that individual recognize that they do have the capacity to learn and grow and do hard things. Everyone's coming in with different scaffolding. Everyone's coming in with different life experiences. And not everyone comes in with that mindset already firmly in place. I know it's something I struggle with.
Very few of us, I think.
Yeah, I definitely, little Ensign Pullman, definitely, I really struggled. And I also really needed the positive feedback of getting qualifications or getting good fit reps to feel like I was competent, which is not a great thing to require, because we're not always awesome about giving those things to people, like vocalizing like, hey, you're doing a really great job. That's another point. Let your people know when they did something well, and what that looks like for each individual is going to be a little bit different. Right.
Yeah.
So I am often telling commands like, hey, give this dude a small win, right? Like, did he follow the MRC card perfectly? Compliment that, because that is not easy for this person right now. So if they did that, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And we forget that. And again, it goes back to, we have this standard that we think everyone's going to have to meet. And I can tell you, this is only going to get harder as our recruitment crisis continues and we start taking in people that maybe we would have turned away before. So we have to be prepared. It's a readiness issue at this point. We have to be prepared to guide people along that path of discovering their self-efficacy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to the point about like, oh, the MRC card or providing that feedback, I think as a leader, especially when I was a department head, and it just felt like from the time I walked across the brow in the morning or into the off-crew building in the morning, the time I left and got in my car, it was putting out fires all day. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if you've ever fallen down, like your foot slips and you fall down one step and then your momentum just like carries you down the rest of the staircase and your life flashes before your eyes. That is what every day felt like, was just like trying not to die. And because of that, I ended up in this sort of habit of correction, 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 see a problem, correct, see a problem, correct. And if you don't really explicitly and intentionally focus on positive feedback, I think in our kind of to-do list, checklist, you know, Navy, it's super easy to lose sight of the compliment. And it's such a basic skill, but so easy to lose sight of. Yeah.
I find too, like I have been lucky to work with some extremely competent behavioral health technicians, corpsmen, and I really have tried to get better about just saying like, hey, you did great this week, or this was a great day. You know, nothing monumental has to happen. We just made it through a busy day. Good job. Yeah. Cause you know, even going out and telling commands this, I still have to very deliberately act on it myself.
Yeah. And I think that's something that I lost sight of as a really junior officer, is I thought that the good leaders, all of this came very naturally. Like, you just showed up one day and it was like, I'm the magnanimous leader that makes good speeches and remembers to thank people and can remember everybody's name and their spouse's name and their kid's name and their dog's name and their hobbies. Like, I just thought, like, good leaders just somehow stuffed all that in their head. And it's taken years to realize that those are cultivated skills, mm-hmm. for one, which is, I guess, why we have this podcast. And two, oftentimes they are still working on those things. They are still having to put effort into making a deliberate, you know, effort for, okay, I'm going to make sure that I compliment people. I'm going to make sure that I recognize progress and effort, not just outcome, which I think is huge. Okay, so when you think about the current mental health system, because I would love to change the system. I'm sure you would too, wouldn't we all? But at the moment, we're just going to exist inside of it. I think a lot of leaders, myself included, have felt or feel very helpless and kind of lost trying to move the needle on the mental health problem. We have a sailor. We have been the sailor who needs help. They get into the system. The system feels overwhelming. What can a leader do who is a SWO, a SUPO, a pilot, whatever, to move the needle without fundamentally challenging and changing the system?
I think one of the most basic things people can do is make sure that they and their folks are using kind of we have the mental health roadmap. Have you seen that before?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there's some non-medical resources on that roadmap. There's the MFLAC. Yes. There's Fleet and Family. There's Military One Source. Now, I know here we do have some really great waterfront MFLACs. Fleet and Family has been chronically understaffed, so they aren't able to take any non-medical counseling cases right now, which is unfortunate. There's also the SAIL program. Are you familiar with SAIL?
No.
I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but I can tell you what they do.
Who can remember all the Navy acronyms? Nobody.
So they're all remote now. It used to be run out of Fleet and Families, but they're all remote counselors who serve as case managers that your command can refer anybody to them. It's intended to be for people who have had suicidal ideations or suicidal thoughts in general. And they actually now have, I think that our area was one of the first places they were trialing it, but they now have remote counseling as well. And it's still going to be the same kind of non-medical resource. So they're not going to be able to deal with like fitness for duty issues or, you know, like full-blown mental health diagnoses, medication, right? But I have utilized that, and they will often provide, we just don't have a lot of resources here, including the network. So they'll often provide kind of some bridging care until we can get somebody plugged in with a higher level of care, which is really important, especially when we're looking at safety for individuals who are struggling with suicidal thoughts. So for example, I know that's in this area. It's not going to be available yet in every area. So looking at the mental health roadmap for your area, there's chaplains on there, you know, finding out what resources are actually viable.
Yeah.
Finding out, you know, all chaplains don't have the exact same level of counseling skills or room in their schedule to be available for ongoing, you know, counseling. Same thing with family, same thing with MFLAC. So find out what that is in your area.
Yeah.
And I would say check in with it maybe every 6 months, because it might change. If you're in a fleet concentration area, there's going to probably be a little bit less variability, but you know, I'm up in Everett and there's not much here. So if one person gets hired, it changes the whole dynamic, right? So becoming familiar with that and referring people to, I hate seeing the lowest level of care, because it implies that their care is less, and it's not. Mm. In fact, all of the people who work at Fleet and Family, all of the MFLACs, even though they're only allowed to do non-medical counseling by their contracts, they are all licensed providers. So I know several MFLACs who have had their own private practice outside of work. So they're all very capable. I would say it's more the most appropriate level of care. And they're usually pretty good about moving somebody on to a higher level of care if they feel like that's necessary. Again, I'm in a small area, so I have a lot of communication with everybody. I'm kind of like a I'm like a base celebrity because I'm the only mental health care provider and the base is like like less than a mile wide. So, you know, everyone, it's easy to get a hold of me because they know who I am. Yeah. That's not always going to be, it's not always that easy to refer to Navy medicine, but it's a good place to start. So whether that's OneSource, Fleet and Family, MFLAX, whatever the resources are in your area, and that's going to vary. So finding out what that looks like.
Yeah. Go ahead. I was just going to say, not everybody, especially if they're a civilian contractor, just because turnover and education and everything, but there was a rule change, I want to say 2019, but please don't anybody come for me if I'm wrong on the year, about warm handoffs for mental health. Mm-hmm. And so it is supposed to be that in the Navy, if you go, and I believe for the other services as well, if you go to Fleet and Family and they can't see you in a reasonable amount of time, or they aren't the right resource, you need medical counseling or something, they are supposed to do what's called a warm handoff. So not just give you a pamphlet that says, go to this other resource, but like help you get the appointment at the mm-hmm. other resource and make sure you are connected to care. And I think that's something that leaders can advocate for, which is if a sailor comes back and says, I tried to go to Fleet and Family and they turned me away or they can't see me for 3 months, any leader can call Fleet and Family and say, hey, I had a sailor who came to you. They need a full warm handoff here. I need to know where they can go. And I need to know that you've helped them through that whole thing, or someone has helped them through that whole thing. And I think we don't advocate for that because it wasn't well advertised that rule change came down.
Yeah. I would also say too, so for medical providers, we can give certain information directly to someone's commanding officer. We're not sharing your medical record. I am also a service member, so I am respected the way I would like mine respected.
Yeah.
But if there is a need to coordinate with the chain of command, you know, I encourage COs to call, or if they designate someone in writing, I do recommend commanding officers think really carefully about who is an appropriate person to designate in writing. So they designate someone in writing, they can also receive that information on their behalf. So for example, a lot of the mentorship recommendations I'm making, the COs here, a DDG CO is not going to go find this guy a mentor, right? So they usually give me written permission to contact their CMC. And then the CMC can kind of take it from there. And my personal policy is, with very, very few exceptions, and they would all be like safety related, I'm always going to tell my patients if I think that we need to get their chain of command involved. And that's even, you know, if I am required to report something, I'm not going to surprise you. I'm going to let you know, which are not always fun conversations to have, but those don't have to be the only conversations that you have with mental health providers for your sailors. If you are respecting the rules around HIPAA, there are still certain things you can do or information you can get that might help you better support the sailors as they go through treatment.
Absolutely. And I think it's hard to get sailors comfortable talking to their leaders about mental health. And for me, like role modeling, talking about my own mental health is a big way to say, like, I am safe because I've been there. I can relate, like sort of like you were talking about with your patient. And I think a lot of it goes to, if you know one of your sailors is going to mental health, when you do that check-in, even if it's just a, you know, hey, pop by my office just real quick. I want to make sure you're getting what you need. Mm-hmm. If you frame it in that way and you say, you know, just so you know, I'm a resource. If you and your provider feel like there are things you need at work, or there are adjustments we can make short term, long term, whatever, please know that my door and my phone line are open. And I think when you provide some of that preemptively, they might even be able to go to the provider and say, hey, my DIVO, my chief, my department head understands and wants to be flexible here and is willing to communicate. And then you can have a much more holistic support system.
100%. 100%. I see so many junior sailors who don't know the things they can ask their chain of command for. I'll ask them, like, did you talk to your chief? Did you talk to your LPO? And they're like, no. Like, it just never occurred to them that they could advocate for themselves in that way. And I think that's not going to change. That's a product of being 20, you know?
And I think it's to give some credit to that fear, I think it is also a product of the fact that particularly 15, 20 years ago, there was a much bigger shut up. We don't want to hear about it. Or I'm going to treat you with weird kid gloves now that I know. And I think a few of those people still exist. And every time the story of my chief took me off of all the watch bills, even though he didn't have to, or they took my weapon so I can't stand armed watch as an MA, so I'm basically useless because my divo, she didn't understand what I was trying to say. I think you hear those stories, and even though statistically they are rare, they are so impactful to that sailor. And then the story, of course, is it confirms something that people are already afraid of, and so it gains traction. And I think being flexible and open with your sailors so that they feel more comfortable with that helps them get over that very real fear.
Yeah, I agree, because that the fear is also a huge factor. It's not just not knowing, but also being afraid to even try. So having that invitation, I think, is really meaningful.
Yeah. So we've talked about, like, within the system, some of the things that we can do. If you had a magic wand and within whatever you're comfortable saying, what policy changes would you like to see more divos, more department heads, more COs lobbying for to work towards positive mental health atmospheres and treatment environments for their sailors?
The first thing, and I've been saying this to my chain of command for a while, pushing it up, I think that the ability to administratively separate someone should be taken away from mental health care providers. Ooh. I'll explain that, right? So
yeah.
I think a lot of people end up in our office because they're trying to hit an easy button.
Mm.
Things are hard. Being on a ship is hard. Yeah. I will not deny that. I struggle. And there's this idea that mental health can be the way out.
Yeah.
And so this causes a few problems. One, when we make mental health the only real viable, non-punitive pathway out, right? Sure, you could go smoke marijuana, but that's going to have some negative consequences. When we make this the only answer to your misery, which some people legitimately just are not adapting, right?
Yeah.
And that makes you more likely to then develop more mental health problems as a result. It's not, yes, people can malinger, people can fake it, and that does happen. But also, it happens subconsciously as well, right?
Yeah.
I have to reach this certain point of being unable to cope before they take me seriously enough that I can get an administrative separation.
Right. So subconsciously, I'm going to not cope.
Yeah, there's a gain to not trying the things that we're recommending, right?
Yeah.
So that's one issue. Another issue it causes is it creates a lot of noise around mental health getting people kicked out. Never mind that the vast majority of these people are coming because they don't want to do this anymore. It just gives everyone the impression that when you go to mental health, you get separated. And that is not the message we want to be sending. So it kind of reinforces this stigma that we have worked so hard to get rid of. Yeah. The third thing it does is it just sends people to our office who didn't start out with a mental health problem. That wasn't the issue. It turned into one. And so now we have less availability to treat all the other people who want to stay in and do have a mental health issue going on, like depression or PTSD or anxiety disorder, which are often extremely treatable things, but our schedules are so full, it's hard to get people in consistently for meaningful therapy. And not every area has the infrastructure with network care to support that. So I have some TAD personnel in my office who I'm using for some admin stuff. And I had them do a project where they pulled all of the TRICARE. They looked up all mental health in all these different ways in the TRICARE website. And if you've ever used that website, I was like, wow, I had no idea it was this confusing.
So bad.
So they pulled up all of these lists. They have called in the last 2 weeks over 600 providers who were listed as currently accepting TRICARE patients. Of those, I believe we have approximately 30 or 40 who are actually accepting TRICARE patients. The closest, if you would like to have an in-person experience, is 17 miles away, which we put in maps to see how long it would take. And it's 30 minutes with like mild to moderate traffic. So we can't rely on external resources to take care of our service members. Also, the quality that they get, there's always going to be variabilities in quality. Everyone's training is different. Sure. Everyone's approach is different. But my experience has been the standard that we maintain in the military is much higher than most civilian providers. We have a peer review every month. We take turns. Like, I look at somebody else's, they look at mine, going through at least five of our notes to make sure we are meeting the standard of care. In most places, that's not happening. If you get a private practice, that, you know, somebody can work out of their garage and you'd never have anybody check their work. And that doesn't mean that they're not providing quality care, but it might. And I've just heard the most bizarre things with people coming back. One person came back and told me their network provider ate lunch during their appointment. Yeah. My mind was like, what? What?
Yeah.
So some people have wonderful experiences. But yeah.
And I think one of the things for me is that when there's already so much fear around things like career impacts, the double fear for me is like civilian providers have no clue when they put that one little word or that one little whatever, you know, they check this diagnostic box or this, you know, insurance code box. They have no training, most of them, on what that's going to mean for me. And I mean, I had an experience where through a number of things, I could not find a way to be seen through anybody who was taking TRICARE. And I was running out of antidepressants, and I just like needed help, needed a stopgap while I figured out the whole TRICARE thing, because I was on remote, which is a whole other problem. And I ended up going somewhere and paying out of pocket just to like see someone and do a check-in and like make sure everything was fine. And they wanted to switch my meds because of a side effect issue, and we talked about it, and that was totally fine. And then I was so afraid to switch it without having a Navy provider look at it, because I was, what if they put me on one of the ones that sends me to a med board, or like what happens then? And so I ended up not filling the prescription for a while, and then going through a Navy doc and being like, look, an external provider suggested this. I just need you to tell me that I'm not going to torpedo my career. And they were like, we prescribe that to everybody all the time. You're fine. And I was like, okay. But I think it just ratchets up a lot of those concerns.
Yeah. And I do see a lot of over-diagnosing by over-pathologizing by community mental health providers. And I think that largely is because we have such higher stakes. When I put something in someone's record, I'm going to be real. Yeah. I'm going to be damn sure that this person has a personality disorder before I put that in their record. I'm going to be damn sure that they have bipolar disorder, because that is going to separate them. Right.
Yeah. Those are some heavy hitters.
Yeah. And I just had someone a few months ago that came to their IDC with their notes from network and had this outrageously scary mental health diagnosis, came to me for evaluation. And I could tell within 5 minutes that he didn't meet the criteria in the DSM. So, you know, it also has the potential to create career disruptions, create a lot of angst too. Being told you have a severe lifelong mental illness that you will only be able to manage with medications. That's scary. Unless there's an extraordinarily real chance that that is accurate, no one should have to go through the stress of processing that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that you bring this up as like policy issue about the quote unquote easy button. Cause I think people overestimate how easy it is to get out of the military by mental health, because they see someone get whisked off the ship and they think it's the magic wand. And I have never met anyone who's actually had a magic exiting the Navy for medical reasons experience. But I think it's interesting that you treat it as a policy issue, because so many people approach it as a personnel issue. They say these are malingerers. They say these people should never have been brought in. They're lazy. You know, they put a lot of moral judgment on it instead of saying, look, if we've incentivized this path. And we've said, this is the clearest path or the easiest path or the one where you get to keep your benefits or whatever. And that's the only one that people know about. It's human nature to say, I want to get from A to B and the clearest path is this one. Of course I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
That's a policy issue where if someone really needs to get out, why would there not be some path that doesn't clog up mental health and put noise to the signal and scare people for sure?
If we give them a way to act on their extreme discomfort that isn't going to mental health, we're also empowering them. We're putting some control back in their hands. And I'd be willing to bet that some of those people won't even go through with it. They may start the process, look into it, but just knowing you can creates tremendous amounts of autonomy that you don't have otherwise. And I think everyone believes this is going to be like a huge Manning crisis if we do it, and it may be the right, but I don't think it's going to be as bad as what people anticipate. And we're already losing them anyway.
Yeah.
Just also taking up a vital resource in the process.
My argument back would be, how many people are we losing because they are unable to get the treatment they need? So their mental health either declines or they get frustrated and they just pull chocks instead of reenlisting. You know, someone out there can do the statistical math, I'm sure, of how many of those people would, if there was an easy button, hit it. How much capacity would that open up for people who want to stay? I'm betting if you did the math, the Navy would come out on top. That's my gut instinct, is fewer people would actually go through with the easy button than we're currently losing because of mental health.
Yeah, that's my hunch as well. We'll never know until there's like a policy change, but you know.
All right, somebody out there who wants to get a PhD, we've given you your research hole. Let us know. I think mine is so silly compared to yours. And this is something that literally I only found out about a year ago when I started looking into carriers. And it's so small, but it's the hill that I would be willing to die on. Why do we still call the mental health professional on the embedded mental health professional, why do we call them a psycho? That is the worst, most stigmatizing name. It's so outdated. I heard that and I thought the person who I was talking to was making a joke. I was like, absolutely not. We do not sit at the wardroom and talk to someone and call them the psycho. And they were like, you absolutely for sure do. And I was like, if anyone from CMP, I think they're the ones who could, or BUMED, is listening, there's got to be a better name. Oh my gosh.
And that's interesting because that doesn't happen for me, and I'm with ships. I'm just not on a carrier. So I'm an HO, embedded mental health officer. I did have a CO that really liked to call me brains, which I thought was hilarious.
I'd be okay with brains. Brains is funny.
Yeah. But brains or EMHO both sound way better than psycho. Although some people, it's fun to kind of be called psycho, but it does kind of feed into that stigma,
It feeds into the stigma for me. For someone who, like, when I was, I'm still in mental health treatment, but when I was initially going through it and I was getting settled on meds and I was like, you know, you're managing all of the reasons you ended up in mental health to begin with. I think if someone had been like, oh, how's your psycho appointment? Or like, you know, have you seen psycho? Like, I think that stuff would have been like just enough of an ick for me to feel a little bit worse. And like, the problem is I think I probably would have gotten over it because I had a support system. Mm-hmm. But I think there's probably a sailor out there who, like, that is the straw where it's like, that's just ick enough that I don't want to do it. So CMP, BUMED, hit me up. We should change that. That's my tiny policy change that I think would have a big impact. Just call them Mo's. Call them the mental health officer. Everyone, or Mento. There you go. Then they could have all sorts of coins that have Mentos on them. It'd be adorable. They can be the Mento. That's my policy change. Okay. What do you think, having been a SWO, especially, when someone ends up in your office, what do you think are the things that their leadership missed before that person ended up in your office or ended up, you know, at a breaking point? What kind of things? Because we hear, what is it, keep path warm, or I don't know, some acronym that I will never, ever remember all of the things to. And we think of it as, oh, they're sad, they're giving stuff away. That's always the big one that I think of, is like they're giving things away, or they're saying goodbye. They're not willing to make future plans. There's some of those kind of obvious signs. What do you think are some of the more frequently missed signs that someone is struggling?
Oh, okay. I think, so first of all, it is 100% okay to be an introvert. I recharge with my book and my dogs, right? And also, I have a social support system, and yeah, I engage with people meaningfully in my work environment. When you see someone who consistently isolates themselves, doesn't look like, I'm thinking of the wardroom specifically, because I see this a lot in the wardroom, but it happens so much with junior sailors too. When they're consistently isolating themselves from others and having no meaningful relationships at work, and you don't have to have your BFF at work, but just meaningfully engaging with people at work besides, I think, I don't want to, let's call it an orange flag, orange or yellow flag. We should look into it. Right?
Yeah.
What's holding them back? Because I think that leaders, if you can get a sailor to give you an honest answer, which you're going to have to work at because you're scary, you've got rank, right? But if you can get them to give you an honest answer, I think you're going to learn a lot about what's going on in that division or that work center.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's about the person. Sometimes it's about the environment. And there are subtle things that their peers are doing, or maybe their work center supervisor is doing, that is making it more difficult for them to become and feel like a part of the team.
Yeah.
So I hear all the time, like, oh, this person keeps themselves, doesn't have any friends on board, as I'm getting the referral. What were you doing with that before they got to the point where they needed mental health care, right?
Yeah.
And then really the biggest thing we preach is, like, I say we, like, embedded mental health in general, like changes, something different.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm not saying there shouldn't be consequences if somebody does something wrong. I'm not saying don't take them to mass, but let's say you have the first class who's had a stellar career and all of a sudden loses their temper and curses out an officer.
Yeah.
Before we run him all the way up, you know, let's maybe explore what was going on there, which hopefully is what's happening at DRB.
Right. That was not my experience at DRB, but fair enough.
I got to sit through my first DRB this last year, and it was very different than the ones I could hear from the PWAs and ENSIN.
Maybe things are getting better.
But I think every CMC, every mess is going to run them a little bit differently. So ideally, the mess is going to pull that string, assuming it's an enlisted sailor. But I don't think it should be only the mess's responsibility. Everybody, the chain should start asking these questions. Like, before the signature is even on the counseling chit, you should understand what was different about today that made someone who'd never behaved this way behave inappropriately. And I think a lot of times we get caught up, we, the military in general, in thinking it's either discipline or mental health or, like, you know, some sort of personal issue. You can hold someone accountable and also help them get the resources they need, whether those are mental health or other resources, right? So in having it not just be a choice between those two paths.
I think that's absolutely
the biggest ones.
Absolutely. I love that. I think that's great. And the changes one for me is so big, because when I think about it, it's like one of the biggest ones that I learned about when I took a mental health first aid class a while back was, like, changes in hygiene, where it's like, if you have the sailor who usually, you know, very well groomed or always has the spiffy haircut, or even, and I am not saying to go ask women who are not wearing makeup if they feel okay, because that's a pet peeve. But if you see someone who's, you know, usually quite put together and something changes and they don't seem to be taking care of themselves, I think a lot of times we think, like, oh, gross, or, you know, that I feel like the knee-jerk reaction from a lot of people is judgment. Like, they kind of turned into a shit bag, when usually there's a missing link in there about something else going on.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Have you ever seen a leader successfully kind of step in early and get someone into care? And how did that go?
Yes. Yeah. As a matter of fact. And I think even recently, so one of my ships deployed and they sent a few people back who kind of fell into that category of these are amazing performers. Something's not right. We need you to look at them ASAP. And so they got prioritized on my patient list, like, okay, let us, as soon as you know their travel dates, let us know, we'll get appointments in so we can help figure this out. And that comes from, I have a lot of trust with that chain of command. They have worked really closely with me on a lot of things. They almost always take my recommendations. And if they don't, they let me know and they explain why, and then give me an opportunity to make any suggestions within what they are able to do. And so the communication is just excellent. And really just them telling me that was enough. Now I am an embedded provider and I have a lot more autonomy than clinicians at hospitals. But I will say when I was at a hospital, and I'm not telling every CO to do this all the time because the system would crumble. But if you have if you're really concerned about safety, if they hold a critical NEC and you need an answer like yesterday on whether or not they can go on this deployment or do this high risk thing, right? You can contact the hospital and you will, if 05, maybe you'll scare them. 06 and above, for sure, they're going to be like, oh shit. You know, a lot of hospital COs are 06s, right? So
it's a peer-to-peer call at that point.
Yes. If you feel like that is what needs to happen because the individual is continuing to run into barriers, sometimes it's just that individual didn't know the right way to walk through the system, but even still it results in the person getting seen sooner rather than later. Yeah. But I would say also with like the command I gave the example of, I get a lot of COs that say, oh, this person needs to be seen right away. And then I look at what their symptoms are, like the IDCs screen them. And I'm like, they don't though. Here are the recommendations. And I will put them on a normally scheduled appointment, which will be 2, maybe 3 weeks out if I have had the nerve to take some leave or something. I know. And they're welcome to come. In the meantime, I let them come to our treatment groups and stuff like that. So not everybody that the CO or chain of command things needs to be seen immediately actually does, but sometimes they do. Sometimes they really need that answer. So on my screening form that the IDC send me, I ask things like, is this a critical, do they have a critical billet? Do they have a critical NEC? What's the impact to command if they are suddenly not able to do their job?
Yeah.
And if something is just not, and there's been miscommunications too. So I've been contacted by commands who assume that I know that this individual is having trouble with their referral, but the individual never called us back. And I'm like, okay, well, we can't fix the system, but we can help them navigate it, which is what I tell them all, but doesn't necessarily stick. You're taking in a lot, you know, to your first mental health appointment. So I would say just really, advocating does, but also please try to trust the subject matter experts when they say like, I hear what you're asking for. This is what I'm recommending instead. Until they give you a reason not to trust them, I recommend that you trust that.
Well, and building that trust, I think, is so important. And like the thing that I want to highlight and make sure people take away from that story is if a ship, a small boy at that, a small ship, can be on deployment and say, I would rather fly these sailors home, get eyes on, and then we'll go from there and we'll either replace them or we'll fly them back with a treatment plan or whatever. If a deployed, like manning limited ship can do that, you can too. Like every leader can take a step back and say, I'd rather lose this sailor for a couple of weeks, or I would rather lose them every Thursday from 11 to 1 while they go to an appointment. We can close that manning gap. We can close that staffing gap and then they will be better and they can come back or not, but at least we didn't completely lose their life. We didn't completely lose them. And I think that's awesome. Whatever ship that is, 2 thumbs up.
I love all my ships, but we have had the opportunity to hone our communication for a while now since before the deployment. Yeah. And so this is just an example of what happens when you work closely with your EMH and you guys get to know each other. You're able to work together seamlessly like this. And it's pretty fucking cool.
That's awesome. I love it. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything you would like to shout out before we sign off?
Yeah, I definitely want to encourage everyone, if you do have an embedded mental health provider and you think that they are a force multiplier, pass that up your leadership. You know, DHA, Defense Health Agency, I'm not going to say anything bad about them. I think they're just trying to do the best they can to come up with an efficient system. But a lot of what EMH does is not measurable in the way that we measure metrics for productivity. And, yeah. and that cultural competency, the working relationships, the preventative care that we provide, the consultation, that's not going to be reflected as easily in the numbers. So if you feel like they're valuable, make sure you're voicing that. Because if not, I think eventually DHA will be looking at pulling these billets back. And I think that we've come a long way in establishing these billets. And that's Greenside, that's Navy, you know, just speak up.
Thank you so much for joining us this week for a slightly different conversation about military mental health. And if you have questions that you want to hear discussed with a military mental health provider, please let me know. I've had a couple of them willing to come on the podcast, and I think it provides so much context and so much more information about the system and about what we can do as either the service member or the service member's leader. And I just think it is something that truly does not get enough attention. So I hope you found this interesting and helpful. Next week's podcast is going to be about how you decide when to take a stand. I went a little off script, but we'll get back to mental health. I've got a couple of more episodes and Substacks coming out about that here shortly. I hope you have a great week, and the spring weather is treating you right.